Jed McKenna's Notebook. All bonus material from The Enlightenment Trilogy. By Jed McKenna. Those who know how to think need no teachers. Mahatma Gandhi. Bonus content from Spiritual Enlightenment, The Damnedest Thing. Recipe for Failure. In the knowledge of the Atman, which is the dark night to the ignorant, the recollected mind is fully awake and aware. The ignorant are awake in their sense life, which is darkness to the sage. Bhagavad Gita. Camille came prepared. He carries a bulging, well-worn, triple rubber-banded notebook full of thoughts, ideas, and questions accumulated during several years of reading spiritual books, attending spiritual gatherings, and participating in spiritual internet discussion groups. A lot of teachers, he informs me, say that the necessary first step in awakening is dissatisfaction, a gnawing discontentment on the feeling level. Is this what you mean when you talk about intent? Most of Camille's reading in recent years has centered on the works of Ramana Maharishi, Nisargadatta Maharaj, Ramesh Basakar, Jean Klein, and that whole crew. He seems philosophically inclined toward the peculiar brand of non-duality and Neo-Advaita Vedanta that attracts a growing audience these days. Its allure seems based on its simple core truth, not two. While not two is not exactly true, two is exactly not true, and therefore succinctly marks the end point of dualistic thought, you'd think. Where non-dual enthusiasts go astray is in trying to erect a philosophical structure atop this simple truth. Truth is always simple and never provides the basis for any philosophy. But Camille is determined to believe that his ramshackle non-dual philosophy is structurally sound. I've explained to him that you can't build a philosophy of this on a foundation of not this. But he is quite attached to his improbable little edifice and not yet ready to decamp. Which is perfectly fine. Waking up is a stop-and-go journey. It takes a lot of hard work to reach a plateau like non-duality, and pausing to rest and acclimatize before moving on is a part of the process. Non-duality may not be the final destination new arrivals might suppose, but getting there is an impressive and challenging feat, and the views are rewarding in all directions. What's more, I like Camille and generally enjoy talking with him. He asks good questions that elicit interesting answers. I'm usually limited to speaking in monologues rather than dialogues, but it's the student who calls the tune, and Camille makes a good job of it. Well, I respond after thinking about his question a bit, I guess it's a matter of degree. Let's try out a new analogy. I'm making this up on the fly, so bear with me. Here's the situation. You're sitting in your skyscraper office, 100 stories off the ground, thinking about how successful you are and how your life is just grand. With me so far? In terms of satisfaction, you're very satisfied. You have it all. Fancy office, great views, the respect and admiration of those around you. Everything you ever wanted. Okay? Okay. So you're like that, happy, content, well satisfied, for however long, months, years, decades. But then one day, for whatever reason, dissatisfaction begins to creep in. Something about your office starts to bug you. It starts with little things. You're dissatisfied with your curtains. They don't go with the credenza at all. What was I thinking? You wonder. How could I have been so blind? And now that you're looking more closely, it's obvious that the carpet is a fiasco and the artwork is just an embarrassment. 1 minute you're happy, the next minute you're very dissatisfied, extremely dissatisfied. This office is simply not an accurate outward representation of your inner professional. You've outgrown it. It actually sounds like a pretty cool office. Yes, well, that's what everyone else thinks. Your friends, colleagues, your family. They think you've got it made and that you're nuts for wanting to mess with it. Of course, you're only dissatisfied when you're in the office. You pretty much forget about it when you're anywhere else. Right? Right. And you're following the analogy, right? These things can be a bit wobbly the first time out. Your office represents your relationship to the larger questions of life, and your dissatisfaction represents... Got it. Good. So, what's the answer? What do you do about this very dissatisfying office of yours? I don't know, he shrugs. Redecorate? Yeah, that sounds right. But this time, you're going to be very serious about it. You're going to bring in a top-notch decorator and strip the place down to the floorboards and start from scratch. You're not going to be a mere dabbler. You're going all the way with this. You're a serious professional, and you deserve a serious office. See what I mean? See how what started as a gnawing little dissatisfaction has grown into a life-transforming event? Okay, he says dutifully. So, that's what you do. You go out and buy books and magazines on interior design. You talk to people and attend lectures and events. You hire the best decorator you can find, someone you resonate with deeply. You yourself are being transformed by this experience. You yourself are growing, developing, expanding. It's very challenging, but you're taking a no-nonsense approach. It's slow going, but little by little, change is occurring. Your office is starting to look and feel like a genuine outer representation of your inner professional. It may take years to get it right, but nothing will stop you. This is too important. In fact, it has become one of the most important things in your life. Right up there with home and family. See what I mean? Yes, he says eagerly. The master decorator represents the guru, and the redecorating process represents the spiritual transformation we undergo when we truly begin to challenge our beliefs and seek higher knowledge. What started out as a kind of gnawing dissatisfaction has grown into the impetus for important change. And although it might seem like a bad thing at first, this is how the process of change works. This is how we develop, how we grow. Exactly, I say. Nobody acts from contentment. We need problems to solve, or else we vegetate. That great office was once something we strived to get. Then it was achieved and enjoyed in contentment. But then discontent sets in to let us know that it's time to move on. So, says Camille, that's what the teachers are talking about when they discuss the dissatisfaction needed to spur us on, right? It might seem bad or uncomfortable, but it's really a good thing. Sounds right, I say. And that's the sort of determination and focus that's required in order to awaken from delusion, to become truth realized? He smiles, excited, like he's just now getting the big picture. So that's what you mean by purity of intent? I smile back. Fuck no. That's what I mean by recipe for failure. His dismay is instantly apparent. I've cut him off in the first rush of a new grokking, and now he's confused and hurt. I did this intentionally. I didn't allow myself to be drawn into this, a lot of teachers say, conversation, just wanting to make a point. I wanted counterpoint. That's what the dialogue has been up until now, because I wanted to make a clear distinction. This is the critical distinction between seekers and finders. This is where the line is drawn, a line the existence of which a lot of teachers don't even suspect. That's the sort of pathetic, half-assed approach that is absolutely certain to keep you confined to your current state. That's the sort of approach that everyone takes, and that's why they fail. He visibly and audibly gulps. Oh. The very people and institutions that are supposedly dedicated to waking us up are doing exactly the opposite. They are lulling us into a more comfortable sleep. That's what we really want, and that's what they really provide. He doesn't seem pleased. Oh, God. Well, then what drives the process of true awakening? Purity of intent. But what does that really mean? Okay. You're back in the office again, totally satisfied with everything. Life is great. Okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So now, dissatisfaction starts to creep in on you. But this time, the dissatisfaction stems from the fact that you smell smoke.
The building is on fire now?
Wake up and smell the coffin, Camille. The building has always been on fire. You were just repressing that knowledge until now. But now, you're aware of it, and it's causing you some dissatisfaction. Quite a lot, in fact, and more with every passing moment. Now, for the first time, you realize that the flames are right outside the door, and the temperature is rising. Acrid black smoke is pouring in. The door bursts into flames. There is no exit. Now you're very, very dissatisfied with your office. In fact, you're starting to hate your office quite profoundly. See how this dissatisfaction, this gnawing discontentment on the feeling level, is of a more immediate and compelling nature than the dissatisfaction brought on by the decor? He nods mutely. Sure. Now your dissatisfaction with your office is quite intense, searing, really. In fact, your dissatisfaction is so intense that it feels like you're on fire. Like you can't stand to be in your own skin. Like anything would be better than more of this. Now you have no thought at all of career, home, or family. Due to a change in your personal circumstances, they've all been reduced to complete irrelevance. Beliefs and concepts disappear, and even death is suddenly small. You're very focused now. You're in the moment, very present. The flames are feet away. Your dissatisfaction with your office is well beyond anything even a master redecorator could handle for you. Agree? He nods. And there's no return, is there? No going back. No do-over. The fire is here. It's a fact. Do you see that? He nods again. And you're completely alone in all this. There's no rescue. Your office is engulfed in flames, and there's no one here to save you. Not Jesus or Buddha or the Pope or your mama. This is your dissatisfaction. This is your problem. This is your agony. This is you about to burn to death. Okay?
Okay.
Okay. So what do you do?
Huh?
Your world is burning. The whole office is in flames. You're in a hopeless, no-escape situation. The pain has started and will only get worse. I think we can safely say that your dissatisfaction is now quite pronounced. What do you do?
Christ, I don't know. Go out the window?
Really?
Hell, I don't know. What else?
Yeah, I guess so. You're in this inferno of an office while outside the window is blue sky, white clouds, and freedom from suffering. That seems like the only possible solution given your very dissatisfying circumstances.
But what?
Well, that's not Hollywood glass in those skyscraper windows. You start flinging yourself against the window, but it doesn't give. Your dissatisfaction is of such intensity that you might break bones and crack your skull from hurling yourself desperately against the window, all to no avail.
Yeah? Then what? What happens?
Well, the obvious thing is that you might simply perish in the hellish inferno. No law against dying. He looks at me desperately. Or maybe you have some object that allows you to break the window out. Or maybe the sheer intensity of your, what are we calling it, dissatisfaction, allows you to break through the unbreakable window. So, boom, you blow out the window. Now there's nothing left in the equation but you, the raging fire, and a 100-story plummet to the sidewalk below. Everything is suddenly quite simple. Perhaps for the first time, your life is perfectly clear.
Yeah? Then?
Burn or jump, I guess.
Burn or jump?
Do you see another option?
Burn or jump,
he says flatly. When you become so dissatisfied with your office that the 100-story plummet and the sidewalk seem like the better option, so dissatisfied that you actually hurl yourself out the window, then you know the level of dissatisfaction necessary to awaken from delusion. He is silent for several moments, head bowed, thoughtful.
I guess dissatisfaction isn't the right word.
Maybe not, I agree. I call it purity of intent. But that doesn't really capture it either.
And that's something every enlightened master went through?
You say it like there are countless enlightened masters dotting the spiritual landscape, but there are extremely few. And now you know why.
Jesus, he mumbles, seemingly sincere in his effort to truly appreciate what he's just been told.
Jesus. I deliver the moral of the story in three easy pieces. The price of truth is everything.
Jesus, he repeats.
Interview with Jed McKenna. The truth is that enlightenment is neither remote nor unattainable. It is closer than your skin and more immediate than your next breath. If we wonder why so few seem able to find that which can never be lost, we might recall the child who was looking in the light for a coin he dropped in the dark because the light is better over here. Jed McKenna. Question. What is enlightenment?
Answer. No self.
Okay. What is no self?
Abiding, non-dual awareness.
Okay. What is?
I can't tell you what it is. No one can. It's not a thing. It's not a concept. It's not a place. There's no explaining fire to someone who's never seen fire. No description can do justice to the direct experience of fire.
I use terms like abiding non-dual awareness and no self and truth realization not because they capture it, but because they seem the least misleading. Most people define spiritual enlightenment very differently from the way you describe it, as if they are talking about an unrelated state. How can there be such disparity?
Enlightenment is absolute. It doesn't come in varieties or degrees. It's not open to interpretation. But the most important thing is that it's self-verifiable and completely available to reason. Anyone who wants to understand can understand. It doesn't require interpreters or intermediaries. It's just sitting there, right out in the open, for anyone who cares to look. No one has to rely on me or anyone else. Becoming enlightened may be a real ball buster, but enlightenment theory is a breeze. The first chapter of the book is titled, That Which Cannot Be Simpler. That's an exact statement. Enlightenment is that which cannot be simplified further, cannot be further reduced. Which brings us to the question of who is enlightened? Who is writing the book? Who is teaching? It's very difficult to reconcile the appearance of self with the claim of no self. And yet, there it is. True self is no self, and there's just no way to make it sound reasonable. I can't express it in a way that anyone is going to get it. I'm aware that there's an apparent contradiction, but it doesn't appear to me. It's like the gateless gate thing. It looks one way from there and another from here. All I can say is come here and see for yourself. That sounds like a leap of faith, not logic. It's simple math. Anyone can verify for themselves the truth of non-duality, the fact that all is one. Any reasonably able-minded person can put it together on their own. From there, it's a short step to no self. Once you have established in your own mind the truth of non-duality, then countless fictions, like the idea of a separate self, shall not long endure. You say reasonably able-minded person. What's really required by way of intelligence for this undertaking? Not much, as my own success attests. It all really comes back to intent. If the intent is in place, everything is in place. If the intent isn't in place, no amount of intelligence will make any difference. So logic is the tool of the mind and desire is the tool of the heart? Sure. Good. Logic, mind, is the sword, and intent, heart, is the will to use it. It's often said that for a book to do well, the author must actively promote it through appearances and media exposure. Why won't you do book signings or radio interviews or any of that? I could answer that a lot of different ways. I could say that the nature of the book doesn't lend itself to that sort of exposure, which is true. I could say that I'm not disposed to undergo that sort of personal exposure, which is also true. But the larger truth is that the book will succeed or fail on things other than marketing and PR. My job was to competently write the book. The publisher's job is to competently produce the book and make it available. How the book fares in the marketplace is none of our concern. Do you care if it succeeds or fails? I'd be amused if it succeeds. I'd be relieved if it fails. I had an urge to express certain things, and now I have, and the urge is gone. That's really the whole story. But you're doing another book. Yeah, there's more material, more fun stuff, but the first book is a complete expression. There are other things to look at, and other ways of looking.
We think of enlightenment as the pinnacle, as the best possible thing, but it's not. There's something far better, and it's the thing everyone who is interested in spiritual enlightenment is really after. There's a lot to be said on that subject if we want to achieve a complete expression and provide a valuable service to the reader. We've received many questions about you personally. People want to know about your history, your relationships, your finances, everything. For instance, do you have friends? Do you socialize beyond the student-teacher relationship? This whole thing really has nothing to do with me personally, and it would be counterproductive to shift the focus onto me. A mind that is turned outward is turned away from the serious business of awakening. People who aren't serious about this stuff are always looking for something to latch onto, some external thing to focus on. But all they really want is to maintain an outward focus. There are plenty of people and organizations that exist to perform that very function. It's easy to understand why people would be curious. The seller-buyer dynamic is the principle on which the entire spiritual marketplace operates. But anyone who wants to make real progress must leave all that codependent mass delusion nonsense behind. This isn't a popularity contest or a democratic process. The major religions have countless millions of intelligent, dedicated adherents. But viewed objectively, they are nothing more than childish fairy tales unworthy of serious consideration. If you can't see that, if you can't get that far, if you can't break free of that rancid consumer mindset, then that's where you should be shining the light of intellect, not on some guy who wrote some book. I'm not relevant to anyone's search. I'm just a finger pointing at the moon. There's nothing to be learned from the finger. Everyone's eager to find a distraction from the real work of waking up. But that's all it is, a distraction. I'm a private person, and I have no interest in participating in anyone's evasive maneuvers. You say you've stopped teaching. How did you come to that decision? There was no decision involved, just an observation. It's easier to understand if we state it more accurately. It's not that I've stopped teaching. It's that I reached the end of the learning process necessary to bring the book into being. Everything, it turns out, was about the book. The many hundreds of hours I've spent in dialogue with seekers at all levels of comprehension was a part of the book's process of becoming. The completion of the book marked the conclusion of the teaching thing. Because, as you've said, everything you have to say is in the book? Because everything was always about the book. Not in the sense that I planned it that way, but in the sense that that's the way it is. You could look at it in a very linear fashion and say that I started writing the book on such and such date, and finished the book on such and such date, but that's a very narrow and incomplete view. That would be a very narrow and incomplete way of looking at any creative journey. Once you remove the blinders of time and space and see the flow of things passing into and out of being, you get a much broader and less linear sense of the flow of things. What you've called an oceanic view, right. You can't really isolate an oceanic event, a wave, for instance. Where in space and time did it begin? Where in space and time does it end? Who can say? It's just one part of something much larger. Why try to chop it into little pieces? For the purposes of comprehension? For the comfortable illusion of comprehension, sure. And that's great. Nothing wrong with it until it's time to get serious and dispense with comfortable illusions. But to bring it back to the teaching thing, I didn't decide
or choose to be done with it. I simply observed that it was over. There it goes, and with it, frankly, goes my interest in spiritual matters. And anyone who would like to have you for a teacher? Seeking a teacher is just ego seeking a reprieve, a stay of execution. Giving oneself over to a teacher, or a teaching, or the beloved guru, or whatever, is all about staying asleep, not waking up. The first rule in this business is that you are on your own. Ego clings to a teacher like a drowning man clings to a log. The teacher is beloved the way the log is beloved. The teaching is sacred the way the log is sacred. The log is the savior, saving us from sinking into the cold, black depths. But what of the students who achieve their awakening under you? I was just there for them. A midwife can hardly take credit for the child. A signpost can hardly take credit for someone's successful journey. Will you miss teaching? Do you think you might return to it? I won't miss it, and I don't think I could return to it if I wanted to. The teacher role is a false persona, just like any other, a costume. It's not the real me, and I doubt I could muster the energy needed to animate the role anymore. It was a garment I wore and have now cast off. It served its purpose. Rather than aiding people in their quest for spiritual enlightenment, it seems like you sometimes encourage them to abandon it. You seem to advise people to see it for what it really is, not necessarily so they can attain it, but so they can stop trying. Does that seem like a fair assessment? Definitely. What it really is so far removed from what many seekers are seeking that it's only humane to try to wave them off. The overwhelming majority of those who read this will be best served in this way. Only a very tiny percentage will be what I think of as serious people, people who are actually in the general proximity of the journey of awakening. As to the rest, unfulfilled seeking is its own thing, its own life theme, and that's what most people are really doing. For them, the seeking fills a very real need, and that's the point, the seeking, not the finding. But they are not aware that they are seeking for the experience of seeking, and not the actual attainment of that which is sought. Sure, necessarily so. And here I should remind you that in the context of being a human being on planet Earth, seeking truth makes sense, and finding it doesn't. You've actually said that enlightenment is a bit silly. Yeah, the whole business is a little goofy. It's strange to hear an enlightened master refer to spiritual enlightenment as goofy. I don't know. It's all goofy. What's not goofy? The first noble truth isn't life is suffering, it's life is goofy. The goofiest people are the ones who take it the most seriously, and no one takes it more seriously than someone who wants to awaken from it. So spiritual seekers are the goofiest people? Well, the world is full of strangely serious people. Are you trying to avoid saying that spiritual seekers are the goofiest people? No, I'm not saying that because I don't think spiritual seekers in general are all that serious. Someone who is truly in the process of awakening would be the most serious imaginable person in the world. But that doesn't apply to many people. Enlightenment is usually touted as the greatest of all achievements, as self-perfection, as the highest aim of humanity, the ultimate goal of every search. But you make it seem almost pointless at times. Well, I wouldn't want to give the impression that it's almost pointless. It's perfectly pointless. Awakening to your true nature is like dying, It's a certainty. Inevitable. You're going to get there no matter what you do. So why rush? Enjoy your life. It's free. Cosmic consciousness and altered states and universal mind are the names of rides in this vast and fascinating dualistic amusement park. So are poverty and disease and despair. Enlightenment, though, is not another ride. Enlightenment means leaving the park altogether. But why leave the park? In the park, you can be a saint, or a yogi, or a billionaire, or a world leader, or a warlord. Be good, be evil. Happiness, misery, bliss, agony, victory, defeat. It's all here. So what's the big rush? When the time comes to leave the park, you'll know, and you'll go. But there's certainly nothing to be gained by it. So you encourage seekers to abandon the search. I'm not trying to encourage or discourage. I'm just trying to express something that is difficult to express and about which virtually everyone with an interest is egregiously misinformed. As you say in the book, in most cases, the enlightenment being bought and sold is not enlightenment at all, but a state of consciousness so crazy-ass wonderful that you'd have to be an idiot not to want it. So insidiously wonderful, in fact, that its radiance has blinded untold millions of seekers to the fact that it doesn't exist. Does this seem to capture it? Essentially, the enlightenment that seems desirable isn't enlightenment, and that aspect of us which is able to desire enlightenment is unable to achieve it and won't survive its onset. Day destroys night. So seeking is doomed to failure? That's a matter of context. I look at spiritual seekers and they seem, on the whole, pretty content. Maybe that's because what they're really seeking is contentment. Seeking enlightenment is an inherent paradox. But who's really seeking enlightenment? In the introduction to her book, Halfway Up the Mountain, The Error of Premature Claims to Enlightenment, Mariana Kaplan states, "The reality of the present condition of contemporary spirituality in the West is one of grave distortion, confusion, fraud, and a fundamental lack of education. In my opinion, there's no real reason to discriminate. The East is no better off in this regard, and perhaps much worse." She also says, "The subject of enlightenment itself is one of the biggest arenas of naivete, ignorance, self-deceit, and confusion in contemporary spirituality. A close second to enlightenment is the category of mystical or spiritual experiences. I might turn it around and say that contemporary spirituality is one of the biggest arenas of naivete, ignorance, self-deceit, and confusion in the quest for enlightenment. But you get the idea. It seems like many spiritual teachers adopt the names, clothing, or titles of their spiritual heritage. But you steer clear of those trappings." Well, I don't have any particular teaching or lineage, and no guru ever renamed me because I never had a guru. In any event, I wouldn't want to give anyone the impression that truth was proprietary or the exclusive domain of some foreign or ancient culture. Truth is one's personal domain, any time, any place. If I were to wear robes or have a Hindu name or a Japanese title, that would only serve to mislead those who ask me to point the way. I don't point east or west. I point right back at the seeker. So you don't think a student needs a guru? That seems to be a matter of endless debate. Whatever it is they're seeking in guru-based traditions might require a guru. I have no idea.
I'm defining spiritual enlightenment as truth realization, and that doesn't require anything but purity of intent. Purity of intent meaning like you described in the book when you talk about your own journey? I had a student named Alexander. At one point in his awakening, he decided that he needed access to a library in Chicago. I never knew why, but he was sure that the next thing he needed could only be found there. So he started hitchhiking from Los Angeles with no hesitation. He had no money, and he looked unkempt and scary, so he had trouble getting rides and had to do a lot of walking. He walked right through his soles, so he had to insert folded newspaper inside his shoes several times a day. It was winter, so he had to do odd jobs along the way for a used jacket, boots, food. Quite an ordeal. 3 weeks later, he makes it to Chicago. He sleeps in a doorway, eats whatever he can find. He carries books with him that he reads whenever the demands of surviving allow. That sounds like a grueling hardship. That's my point. If you were to use the word hardship to Alexander as he sat exhausted, cold, and hungry in that doorway, he'd have just stared at you as if you were a yapping dog. I'll also point out that 6 months earlier, Alexander was a very normal guy with a wife, kids, a house, and a job. There is no hardship. There's only the next thing, the next step, the next battle. The point is always to get the next door unlocked. The Bible says to pluck out your eye if it offends you. If Alexander's eye were preventing him from opening the next door, it wouldn't occur to him not to remove it. That's the fuel that drives this journey. It's not in scriptures or temples. It's no one's to give or withhold. That's what I mean by purity of intent. You describe a process of awakening that generally takes 2 years, plus another 10 to integrate. Yet many spiritual teachers describe enlightenment as the result of an instantaneous, transformative event. I would guess that they've undergone the kind of experience that Buck talks about in the book Cosmic Consciousness, some sort of mystical insight into the heart of creation, or something equally transcendent and transformative. Great stuff. I've had mystical experiences myself, and I wouldn't even try to express the wonder of them. But the idea that someone can awaken to no self in a flash is simply absurd. Such people are talking about something wonderful, but it's not truth realization. It's not abiding non-dual awareness. There's a lot of talk among spiritual teachers suggesting that we're currently undergoing a massive shift in consciousness and that mankind is entering a new age of spiritual upliftment. Do you see such a shift taking place? No. People who talk about an enlightened humanity are talking about a world where the lamb lies down with the lion and everyone is happy and healthy and whole. In short, a world without conflict, without drama. But that would be very silly, since the whole point of duality is division. The whole point of opposites is opposition. This is the drama, not a still life. And no awakened being would ever suggest that everything wasn't just perfect the way it is. To return to the amusement park analogy, imagine a group of self-proclaimed visionaries who want to smooth out all the roller coasters so there were no scary plummets or loops, just long, slow, safe circles. Great, but what's the point? Anyone who says there's a shift coming and those who follow their teachings will ride the wave are in the sales business. More accurately, they're in the business of selling something that's not theirs to sell. They get asked why no one who buys ever receives the product. And this is the stock answer. We'll all make the big shift together. That's how they keep the dogs wagging their tails. From the book, it seems you never engaged in any of the normal spiritual activities. You're not a meditator. You never used a koan, never had a mantra, never had a guru or teacher. This challenges a lot of people's closely held beliefs about how spiritual realization is attained. I never thought of waking up as a spiritual pursuit. I just wanted to get to the truth. Looking back, I can see where I might have used the word infinity in a koan-like manner, kind of a Western version of mu. Infinity is beautiful. It destroys everything it touches. It annihilates all concepts, all beliefs, all sense of self. No teacher, teaching, book, or practice could ever be as effective as simply allowing the thought of infinity to slowly devour you. Even more so than spiritual autolysis? Spiritual autolysis invariably leads to infinity. I mean, where else? The deficiency of recorded accounts. This is the personal account of a 2-year journey during which I experienced the falling away of everything I can call a self. It was a journey through an unknown passageway that led to a life so new and different that, despite 40 years of varied contemplative experiences, I never suspected its existence. Because it was beyond my expectations, the experience of no self remained incomprehensible in terms of any frame of reference known to me. And though I searched the libraries and bookstores, I did not find there an explanation or an account of a similar journey which, at the time, would have been clarifying and most helpful. Owing then to the deficiency of recorded accounts, I have written these pages trusting that they may be of use to those who share the destiny of making this journey beyond the self. Bernadette Roberts, Introduction, The Experience of No Self, A Contemplative Journey. Dr. Pillay, Interview. These four questions came from Dr. Cribin Pillay, editor and founder of the Noumenon Journal. You've referred to enlightenment a few times as abiding non-dual awareness. Is it possible to say more about what this is? The term non-dual awareness is an attempt to capture the living reality of otherlessness in words. This term, non-dual awareness, seems like a reasonable portrayal of the state from within the state. The word abiding distinguishes it from any of the fleeting states commonly mistaken for, or sold as, spiritual enlightenment. Actually, I think the worst term for spiritual enlightenment is spiritual enlightenment. As I said in the book, I didn't realize until several years after my awakening that what I had achieved was what people meant when they said spiritual enlightenment, at least what those people meant who used the term to mean the absolute state rather than a higher-level dream state, like unity consciousness. The experience of unity consciousness certainly feels more like something you'd want to call spiritual enlightenment, but it's not lasting. So what is it? A sweet dream. The most wonderful thing we can experience, I'd agree, but not a permanent awakening from delusion. The best term might be truth realization. The term spiritual enlightenment perpetuates the mist-enshrouded mountaintop mystique, whereas truth realization sounds natural, reasonable, and within reach. Spiritual enlightenment is for the ultra-elite, but truth is everyone's business. How would spiritual autolysis work if someone, still enlightened, went around saying their enlightenment is abiding non-dual awareness? Exactly. That's the question. Calling it abiding non-dual awareness might be an adequate description from within, but is it useful from without? Is it useful for the seeker to know and call it by that name? And the answer is, I think, not very. In the book, I made an effort to convey the daily reality, even banality, of my experience. I wanted to hold myself up as an awakened being and say, look, this is it. This is what it's really like. So the term abiding non-dual awareness serves that purpose, but it's probably not the most illuminating term for the seeker. For the purposes of trying to achieve this state, I think the terms no-self, truth realization, and non-duality are of more practical value. You mention that you enjoy books written by those who have attained enlightenment and who write well about what it's like. Can you name a few authors? I'm going to sidestep this question in order to provide a more pertinent answer. The goal of the genuine seeker is always to take the next step, to open the next door. Waking up is not a scholastic pursuit or a conceptual challenge. The ability to open the next door is the only thing that matters, and the key can come in any package: a book, a stubbed toe, an advertising jingle, a leaf of grass. If your intent is in place, then the universe will act as your librarian, and you'll always have what you need when you need it. Some teachers like Yuji Krishnamurti posit that the individual can do nothing about becoming enlightened simply because it means the end of the individual self-sense. You are emphatic that it can happen through conscious intention, and that it should take no longer than 2 years after the first step has happened. How would you view Yuji's work and Balsikar's, whom you quote, because it brings up the old debate about destiny and free will in the pursuit of enlightenment? Firstly, the debate of destiny and free will is a non-issue, a dry hole. It is based on false assumptions and false knowledge. Through clear seeing rather than belief, any such question can be transcended, destroyed, and the whole matter left behind. It's just another gate to get stuck behind for a while and eventually pass beyond when you discover it was never really there. Obviously, no answer is possible. The trick is in seeing that the question, too, is not possible. Secondly, yes, I'm emphatic. Not only can it happen through conscious intention, it can only happen through conscious intention. To say that the individual can do nothing to break free of dualistic perception because it results in non-dualistic perception is nonsensical, like saying a living being can't step off a cliff because it results in death, or that a dreamer can't wake up because he's dreaming. However, if Yuji Krishnamurti and others were saying that self cannot achieve no self, then that's perfectly correct. The end of the one marks the beginning of the other. No one can have their cake and eat it too, despite what so many egotists and profiteers would have us believe. Is it a paradox? Yes. Can it be explained so people will understand? No. Can people come see for themselves and understand it directly? Yes. How? Claw, scratch, bite, and burn. Burn everything. Think for yourself and figure out what's true. You figure out what's true through a process of elimination by figuring out what's not true. That's the master key. Follow the truth. Ultimately,
That's my only advice. The clock is ticking, and you're completely on your own. Forget concepts, forget philosophy, forget spirituality, forget what anyone else says. Don't try to dictate terms. Just think for yourself and figure out what's true. You can do it.